Welcome to the official podcast of The Hoffeld Group. Your host is the CEO and Chief Sales Trainer of The Hoffeld Group, David Hoffeld.
Welcome to the official podcast of The Hoffeld Group, where we provide you with powerful sales insights that are based upon proven science and will help you sell more. I'm your host, the CEO and Chief Sales Trainer at The Hoffeld Group, David Hoffeld. And today we are joined by a very special guest, Victor Antonio. Victor has been a CEO of a multi-million dollar tech company, VP of international sales for a Fortune 500 company. He's authored 12 books, 20 sales training programs, and is a sales trainer, keynote speaker, and the host of Spike Television show Life or Debt, where he teaches families struggling financially how to run their family like a business. Victor, it's great to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me, David. I appreciate it.
Well, let's jump right into it, because one of the questions that a number of people wanted me to pose to you when I informed them that I was going to have you on the podcast was about your new television show, Life or Debt, which airs Sunday nights on Spike TV. And one of the common questions was, how did Victor, a lot of people I talked to were familiar with your YouTube channel and your work, how did he get cast for that show? So, Victor, how did you get cast for that show? How'd that come about?
That is probably the most popular question I get. Everybody swears I have a master plan, but they found me on YouTube. That's the short answer, David. They found me on YouTube. The production company was looking for, they had come up with this concept for the show Life or Debt. They were looking for a host, and I think they had looked at over 500 people. And from what I gather, from what the production guy told me, one of the two brothers who run the production company, Tim and Mike Duffy. And Mike Duffy said he was surfing one day on the web, one evening rather, because they were getting desperate to find the right person that has the right characteristic, but also, you know, firm, stern, but, you know, still has the business knowledge. And he said he came across one of my videos. And I remember after that, they called me, and I thought it was just a joke. You know, somebody says, I'm calling from Hollywood. I'd like to talk to you about hosting a show. Which I, you know, in my mind, I'm screaming, yeah, right, you know? And so that led to a conversation. We had a great conversation. We went back and forth. And then they flew me out for a screen test where I had to work with a family. And there were two other people competing for the position. They had narrowed it down to three. And I was the third person. And I think the moment when I knew I probably got it, or at least made an impact, was I was the third one up. And so what you do is you walk into the house, there's a couple, cameras everywhere, and you just have their financials. And the husband, you know how people sometimes, David, talk in circles but never answer your question?
Yep.
And I had that husband. And so finally, I said, give me a piece of paper. And I remember I wrote everything down. And when he told me this is what he was going to do, I'm looking at the numbers. I'm thinking, no way. So I basically, you know, circled the number, turned the paper around, slid it back his way, and say, is that what you tell me you're going to do next year? He said, yes. I said, you're full of bleep expletives. And, you know, because it was just irritating. I was in a bad mood that day, I guess. And at that moment, you can hear, like, crickets. You know what I mean? The screen just, the whole set just went silent, David. Because I think the other two guys didn't yell at the husband. And it wasn't that I wanted to yell at him gratuitously. The man was just irritating me, David. You know what I'm talking about? It's just, you know, you get to the point where he had to be confronted. Yeah. And that was the moment. After that, we did the pilot. Which was actually episode number three, the Martinez family, for the season. And once they saw the pilot, you know, Spike TV said, hey, go ahead and greenlight 10 more episodes. So that's the shortest version of that story. But I've never done TV. I've never been in front of a camera. And basically, I think, you know, it's really the whole premise of the show is how do you teach families to run their household like a business? And that's really the underlying premise of what we do with the show.
Excellent. Well, I think you are really a good host, and I wanted to explore maybe briefly the relationship or the correlation between being a business reality TV host like yourself and also being a change agent in business. I think there's a lot of connection there, because on the show, as you mentioned, you know, you have to be likable, but also you can't put up with excuses. You got to drive a change initiative. So obviously, when you meet with a family on the show, you have a certain mentality. So I guess my question would be, what are the specific qualities that make you or anyone a good business reality host, but also a change agent in the real world as well?
If you really look at the show, what's really fascinating about the show, Life or Debt, is that it is a personal finance show, but it's 80% personal, 20% finance. If you really study it, this show is a behavior modification show. That's really the best way of looking at it. It's how you get people to psychologically shift their mindset. And if you notice in the show, there's always a point, at least one or two points, where we try to put the couple or the individual through an experience, almost to wake them up. I always say, you know, you got to shake them up to wake them up. So, for example, we just did the Aaron Carter, who's a celebrity, singer, lost all his money. And one of the things I did was I calculated his net worth and what his net worth should be, what he should have in the bank. And if you remember the episode, we took him into a vault and we showed him $2.7 million. Mm-hmm. And we said, that should be in your pocket or in your bank account right now. And it's not. And that visual, you know, it hit that reptilian brain. You know what I mean? That amygdala lit up, because once he saw all that money that should have been his, it's like visually it hit him. So that was the first shift. And then the second shift, he's used to being the star. This time we made him the servant of a band. In other words, he had to be the manager. He had to serve a band, not be the band. And when he went through that experience about what it takes to put a show together, you know, get people to show up at the nightclub, collect the money, you know, negotiate fees, all that stuff, you know, this was starting to wake him up. In other words, he was doing it. So the show is very experiential in the sense that we make them do something that wakes them up. So if I'm a business leader and I'm looking at this show and how would it relate to my business, if there's something that you want your salespeople to really get, maybe that one individual you really want to change, ask yourself, what could I make that person do? What experience could I give him or her that would wake them up in such a way that they go, ah, I get it.
Excellent. Absolutely. Yeah, I love that. It's a behavior modification and really that experience, creating the context for change. Let's drill down maybe a little on the theme of the show, and that is really managing your money and your family like a business. Because a lot of our listeners are sales professionals, business mm-hmm. leaders. Many are highly successful, but you know, some will confess that at the end of the month, in spite of the fact that they make a good income, they don't have any money. So can you give our listeners maybe some guidelines that they can follow to make sure they're handling their money in a wise and effective manner?
Yeah, in other words, they have more months at the end of their money, something like that, right? They just got,
exactly.
You know, that kind
of
thing.
Exactly, one of those,
And so what happens is, you know, we teach, look, from a business standpoint, what we teach the families are what we do in business, right? With the families, we say, look, there's several ways you can hit your magic number, which is how much money you need to make to pay your expenses, pay down your debt, and also save. We call that the magic number, right? Any sales professional or business manager or business owner has a magic number, how much money they have to make to cover the expenses, you know, clear out the debt, and put some money away for long term. So again, the correlations are right there. And so what we say, in order to hit your magic number, is you got to either increase your revenue or decrease your expenses. And I think, you know, as simple as that may sound, it's mind-blowing how many people just don't implement that, you know, that strategy. So if I'm a sales professional and I don't have enough money at the end of the month, I got to ask myself, what am I going wrong? And if it's, you know, and I got two levers to work with, I can either increase revenue or cut costs. Well, let's just say the easiest thing is to always cut costs. That's the easiest part, right? But it's amazing how we can actually squeeze more out of something if we really try. But then if I'm a salesperson, I'm thinking, how can I make more money? Well, if I'm hitting my number and I'm not making enough money, what do I need to do to move it to the next level? You know, what do I need? You know, how many calls a week do I need to make? How many presentations do I need to have? How many sit-down meetings do I need to have? And find a way to generate that revenue. But it's really a discipline where you really don't want to overextend yourself by spending too much money. A lot of these families, you know, some of the things they buy, David, you know, some of the things they own just to keep up with the Joneses, it's amazing. So if I'm a sales professional or a business owner, you know, look at cutting costs. And then I would look at obviously increasing revenue. And you'd be amazed what happens when you just focus, when you really focus, David, on those two things. If a sales professional tells me they're not, you know, at the end of the month, they don't have enough money, there's something wrong. You know, either they're living beyond their means or they need to increase their means. And I don't know if that's a sympathetic answer, but that's the realest answer I have.
And I think just having that strategic perspective and applying it. Sometimes we're so good at applying it in our work, but we oftentimes forget or neglect to apply it to our own lives. So bringing that business perspective and that focus into our own life and our own finances can be life-changing, as your show demonstrates.
Yeah, David, if I can add something, David, because you bring up a good point, that sometimes there's almost like this firewall between what we do in business and what we do at home. It's funny how we're efficient at business, getting all the phone calls in, hitting all the customers we need, getting all the proposals out, being on time, you know, getting to the meetings. We do all these things efficiently. But then it's like when we get home, it's like we just get sloppy. We don't know the numbers. We don't know where all the money's going. We're not managing to a budget. But yet at work, you got a profit and loss center, right? And you're managing towards a budget. You watch your marquee dollars. But when we get home, we get lazy. And if we can just break that firewall mentally, you know, I think that would be a breakthrough in and of itself.
And that's a great insight. And I think a great takeaway for our listeners. I would encourage all of us, it's good to review, regardless of your financial situation, and just to analyze yourself. And as Victor, as you so eloquently say, you know, to treat your family and your life as if it were a business. It gives you a new perspective and a new focus. And I guess that's one thing that I've seen consistent in not just the show, but of course all your work, your seminars, your keynotes, your books, your YouTube channel, which is great, a great resource that I'd highly recommend for our listeners to check out after listening to the podcast. A lot of great videos on there, but it's about change. It's about changing behaviors. And I think all of us want to do that. All of us have areas of our professional life or personal life that we want to change, and also we want to inspire change in others. So what are some principles, Victor, that you can share with our listeners that will help them do that, that will help them inspire change in their own life and also help inspire it in others?
You know, one of the questions I get a lot is, you know, what do you do to stay motivated? That's always a good question I get.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, well, there's moments where I don't feel motivated, you know, and after a while, you know, that's thy own self be true, that you really need to understand your own bad habits. And let me give you an example. Sometimes I know I need to do something and I wait till the last minute to do it. I bet you a lot of people listening to this could relate to that one, right? And so one of the things I've learned to do over time is to lie to myself. I said, let me just sit down and do this for 5 minutes. That's all I'm going to do, just 5 minutes. And you know what winds up happening, right, David? You'll wind up spending a good 30, 40 minutes on it and get out of the way. But what's interesting that let's go psychology here for a bit, because I think this is a fascinating topic, because we become inefficient when we stop doing a lot of things that we should be doing. Allow me to explain. We got 10 things on our plate that we should do. And we know we need to do them. We should kind of, get the to-do list out and start knocking them down. But yet we put them off. And so what happens, it rattles around in our brain. And you know the phrase. It's called cognitive loading. And you got so many things on your brain that you wind up making bad decisions because you're cognitively loaded. You're thinking about too many things. You're worrying about too many things. Now, a lot of these things could be solved if you just got up an hour early and knocked these things out really quickly. So what I've learned is that, you know, when I'm demotivated, it's usually because I got too many things going on. And so I have to stop myself and say, what do I need to start doing? You know, again, the to-do list. But I'm also very self-aware that if I let all these things continue to linger, I continue to make bad decisions or poor decisions. And there was an interesting study where they gave two groups of people, you know, several digits to remember. One group had like a 2 or 3 digit number to remember. The other group had like a 7 or 8 digit number to remember. And then when they went to lunch, they were asked, whether you like a salad or would you like this piece of cake or was it a cookie, some sweet. And what was interesting is that those who only had to memorize 2 or 3 number made the healthy choice and went with the salad. Those who had the 7 or 8 digits to memorize, they were cognitively loaded, went for the sweets. In other words, a poor decision. A perfect example of what happens when you're overwhelmed, you just make bad decisions. So, you know, one of the things I want to tell people is that you just start knocking things out. Don't let things linger. Don't retouch something. I don't know if you know what I mean by that, David. It's like you start doing something, but you don't finish it and you'll come back to it later.
Mm-hmm.
And then you touch it for a while and you'll come back to it later again. And sometimes you really just need to knock it out. One of the things I do that really helps is that, and, you know, for me to clear my mind is every day I take a good 45-minute walk. I squeeze it in the day, you know, and that allows me to just really relax and let my brain just kind of wander. It's amazing what creative solutions you come up with when you're just, you know, listening to some nice ambient music and you're walking. And so, you know, if you're listening to this and you feel stressed sometimes, you feel overwhelmed, take a nice walk. There's something about movement, something about, you know, freeing yourself from, I always put the do not disturb on my telephone when I walk so I can just enjoy the 45 minutes. There's something about that that puts you in a better space. So when you come back home, you're ready to do some work.
Yeah, wow, a lot of great takeaways there from the value of exercise, the cognitive loading. Yeah, spot on. There's so much research that shows it does not take very much to overwhelm our brain, and that creates decision fatigue. We make then poor decisions as a result. So a lot of great insights there for our listeners to kind of sift through. And I guess that kind of maybe transitions into a question I wanted to pose to you as well, which one thing I really appreciate about your work is that a lot of it is based on research, as you just shared, studies from behavioral science, neuroscience, behavioral economics. So I noticed in a lot of your work that you leverage that, and that's rare because that's kind of what we do at my firm is we specialize in that. So I always appreciate when I see others in the sales world doing leveraging research as well. So my question is, how did you first get exposed to this research? And also, as you've deployed it with your clients, what kind of results have you seen achieved by basing behaviors on solid research?
The story is about 7 or 8 years ago, 2008. I remember I was in Utah. I was bored. I was waiting to do a speech the next day. I go to the bookstore and I see this book called Influence by Robert Cialdini. You know, and I started reading this book, Influence. Yeah, I think it has six keys or six social proofs. I have six keys to influence, one being social proof. But anyway, so I went through this book and I go, okay, this is interesting. But as I was reading through the book, I started noting some of the other people that were in there, that were, you know, because he references a lot of studies in there, right, amongst his own. And then I got turned on to a guy named Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, you know, that duo. And I started reading some of their stuff, and that led me to reading everything. I don't know, I just got hooked on neuroscience. You know, the advances with, you know, functional magnetic resonance imaging machines, you know, where you can actually see inside a person's brain, is really fascinating to me because and you know this already, David, because you're in this field, is that the average consumer today is so much smarter than they were 20 years ago, pre-internet. So I believe there's two types of buyers, pre-internet and post-internet. And we're dealing with post-internet people now. And they know a lot. They've done the research. Google had a study that says they look at 10 sources of information before they reach out and contact you, which means that they're pretty much loaded up with good information already. The CEB did the study that I'm sure you're familiar with, the people who wrote the book, The Challenger Sale, you know, that the buyer is 57 and that sometimes even others would say 70% into the buying cycle. Yeah. You know, in other words, they've already pretty much, there's something called preference formation. In other words, their preferences are almost all already formed by the time they talk to you. So if a customer is arriving at the door, you know, and they're loaded already, you know, to bear with information, you don't want to sound like a walking brochure. And the problem with a lot of salespeople I see today is that they try to sell, you know, that Glengarry, Glen Ross, ABC, always be closing, you know, and that doesn't work anymore. I don't care who says this. It doesn't work anymore. You may get a couple of sales here and there forcing people to buy something, but that'll be buyer's regret later on that you'll pay for. And so understanding that the consumer has changed greatly. So then how do we change? Then that's why I like looking at the neuroscience piece. Because they really get into some of the, you know, the subconscious things that are going on inside the customer's brain, why they're hesitating, you know, that, you know, when you activate, you know, when you, their alarm system, right, the amygdala lights up, right, the reptilian brain, you know, fight, flight, or freeze, you know, it's, you know, once you do that to a customer in a one-on-one conversation, if you understand what locks a customer up, if you understand why they're afraid, because at the end of the day, you're dealing with a primal brain. You know what I mean? You're dealing with the primal brain. If you understand how the primal brain works, then you can adjust your pitch to that primal brain. And so, you know, one study showed, I forgot which, I can't reference it right now, but it was something interesting that subconsciously you've already made a decision. And like, it's like 3 milliseconds later, something like that, that you're conscious of that decision. In other words, you made a decision already at a subconscious level. And they show this by showing that in the fMRI machines, that certain part of the brain, the decision-making part of the brain, already made that choice for you. but you then become conscious of it later, which means that there's a lot of stuff going on inside a buyer's brain. So when I do training or I do speaking, I really speak to, you know, what triggers a buyer to say, no, let me think about it. Or what triggers them to just say, never get back to you? You know, what did you do wrong in the presentation that caused that person to react in such a way? And I love reading neuroscience material, behavioral science stuff, because if you can embed, I guess, that knowledge, you know, those results, those applications into your presentation, which I think is where the rubber meets the road, I think you'll be a better, more effective salesperson.
I couldn't agree more. I think that's the future of selling, is leveraging this science to better serve buyers and really align how we sell with how the brain is wired to buy and wired to be influenced. So yeah, absolutely. And I guess the role of that in selling and how selling has changed, as you have already mentioned, with the internet and the influx of technology, we're in a hyper-competitive marketplace. As you mentioned, Victor, we're entering into the sale at a later time than really ever before in history because of all this information saturation that our buyers are engulfed in. So selling has changed a lot. There's no doubt about it. I guess maybe from your perspective then, what is the biggest mistake that you see salespeople make right now in this new customer-driven world? And what can they do to neutralize that mistake, to counteract that, to not engage in it?
Good question. I alluded to it a little bit, and that is that when we talk about preference formation and the customer arriving at your doorstep, so to speak, you know, already armed with information, that the worst mistake you can make, the mistake you can make, is to tell them something they already know. You know, there's no way you're going to position yourself as a trusted advisor, somebody they believe, if you tell them things they already know. And so I always like to use like a Best Buy example, and I like Best Buy. But let's say I've done my research on a camera and I walk into Best Buy. Let's give it a real tangible example here. And I walk in and I already know what I want. I want the Nikon D7000 because it has blah, 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 blah features, right? And that's what I'm looking for. If I go to the store and I ask one of the, you know, I guess the salespeople there, and I said, tell me about this camera. And they just tell me everything I already know. I said, okay, great. And I know that In that interchange, I didn't get any information from this. After a while, I'm not going to want to go to Best Buy. I can just buy it online. But right. Let's just kind of take scenario B. I go there. I'm already ready to buy this D7000 unit, right? And all of a sudden, the salesperson says, well, why are you choosing that camera? And he asked me a couple of questions, like good salespeople do. And then all of a sudden, he throws in that wonderful word. He gives me some insight. And, you know, if you've seen my videos, I define insight as information beyond the obvious. That's what customers want. That's what the best salespeople do. Give me some insight. Give me some information beyond the obvious. Tell me something I don't know. Tell me something I haven't thought of and help me avoid those pitfalls. In other words, if I was to walk into Best Buy and I was so dead set on buying this camera, then that salesperson shifted my perspective by asking me a couple of questions and then highlighting certain things I didn't know, then I'm like, I'm so glad I came to the store. And that's part of the buying experience, right? When you're talking to somebody who's very knowledgeable, when you take it to a B2B level, that was a B2C example, when you take it to a B2B example, not only tell me about the product, tell me about my competition, what they're doing in the market, tell me where the market's going, tell me how this is going to really help, you know, me grow my revenue or cut my cost. Again, back to the same levers, right? Increase revenue, increase income or decrease cost. That's what people want to know. But that's, if I can talk about my product and then again, in such a way that you haven't thought about it, then I'm providing insight, information beyond the obvious. And I think that's what today's salesperson needs to do. For the first time ever, I really think it's not what you sell, it's how you sell. And I think Neil Rackham, it's been selling, who said that. And I thought that was just genius, because it isn't what you sell, it's how you sell, because we've reached a point of product parity. All the products are almost the same. I'm sorry, but they are. Again, a couple of companies will have some differentiating products. But again, that differentiation doesn't last long in the market. So then where's the differentiator? It's not the product. Typically, it's not the marketing. Maybe it's not even the access or the distribution channels. It's the salesperson. It's marketing and the salesperson, that combination. So I think salespeople are actually more valuable today than ever because of product parity.
Yes. Excellent. Wow. Well said. Well said. That's worth listening to again for our listeners. Yeah. That's spot on. That's powerful. I couldn't agree more with everything you said there. I think today's consumer is demanding value, not just from what they buy, but they're demanding value in the sales process and that insights of creating that buying experience that gives them that value. It's a key differentiator. Spot on. Absolutely. Well, that's a great insight and some great takeaways for our listeners to think about. Are you doing that? We can all kind of nod our heads and agree with what Victor said there, but are we living that out in the real world? And even if so, how could you improve? Asking those kind of questions will spur that change that can help you sell more and better serve your buyers as well.
Agreed.
Victor, I wanted to ask you as well about it. It's from our experience here, just our listeners listening to you here on the podcast, and from your videos and your speaking and your television show, it's clear you are a very accomplished presenter. And I know you've invested a lot in there from Toastmasters as well as over the years honing your skills in that area. So I wanted to ask you about presentations, because a lot of our listeners are sales professionals who deliver sales presentations on a regular basis. So what are some strategies that you could share with them that will help them capture the attention of those they're presenting to, of engaging them and drawing them into the content of their message?
Yeah, I think here's where the greatest crime is committed in selling. David, I'm going to give you the greatest crime committed in selling.
All right.
Here it is.
Right.
Here's drum roll, right? And that is that the corporation spends millions of dollars doing research and development to actually develop a product, puts in place manufacturing, gets the facility, puts all the GSA, all the overhead in place, millions of dollars. But when it comes to where the rubber meets the road, and that is the salesperson presenting to the customer, the one-on-one, the one-to-a-group, that's where we spend the least amount of money on. And that is the greatest crime in selling. The majority of salespeople I meet follow the Pareto principle, right? The 80-20 rule. 80% are just horrible presenters, in my opinion. Horrible. When I do events, what I do, if a company brings me in to do a speaking engagement, a keynote, I always go up to the workshop or get there early so I can listen to some of the other keynote speakers. And these keynote speakers are basically not really keynote speakers. They're professional salespeople actually doing presentations, right? And I just cringe, Dave. I mean, I just cringe. And I almost can't be in the room because these presentations are so horrible. And, this person's a director of sales. This person's a VP of sales. And I'm like, you're horrible. And it's amazing to me that, if they're doing well with that level of selling, with that approach, with that pitch, imagine if they actually knew how to present, if they knew how to frame a conversation, if they knew how to, insert pattern interrupts at the right place. Imagine if they knew how to block objections throughout a sales process or a sales presentation. Imagine all these things in a nice presentation. But the majority of salespeople I see are horrible presenters. I hate to say it. I'll probably get a hell of a lot of emails about this one, but I hate to say it. They're horrible. It's almost like it's death by PowerPoint. We've all been in those rooms where they're just clicking through slides. They're turning their back to you. They're showing bullets, 20 bullets on one slide. They're not selling you. And by the way, when I say pitch, I'm not talking about cheesy pitch. Excuse me. I'm not talking about, your cheesy sales pitch. I'm talking about you're doing a product presentation where it's a $3 million, deal on the line. You're talking to the CXOs of the corporation. You got a couple of maybe engineers, service people in there, support people. You got the whole kit and caboodle. And your job is to do a presentation where you address all their needs, knock them down, and block objections as you go through, but also keep them interested, keep them engaged, and just keep that momentum going. Most salespeople who present, they last a good 5, maybe 7 minutes after one joke and a couple of data points. You can just see that their curve just dies. I mean, they just go down and they never recover. And so what happens is that, the people tune out. Again, if you understand behavioral science, you know that our attention span is just, the way the brain works, it's going to reallocate resource if what you're telling me is not important, David. If you're talking to me and it has nothing to do with me, my brain says reallocate. And so what do most people do? They grab their phone. We've all seen people scrolling their phone while somebody's presenting. That's a perfect indication that you have just presented information that nobody cares about, especially that person that's playing with their phone. And so I think that's where salespeople make the mistake. And I think it's part and parcel with marketing. Marketing gives them a bunch of slides. They then take the slides, put them together, and then they do the presentation. And I think it's sad. It's a crime that many of these companies, and that's why I think companies like yours, you know, could help, you know, with the sales presentation to come in and say, no, this is a, it's not a sales presentation. To me, it's something that builds momentum to a culmination called close. And that's the advancement to the next level, whatever the sales process is, right? But a lot of companies don't do that. They just kind of throw a bunch of slides. New product comes out. They just throw in the slide deck and the salespeople just present. And it's that show up and throw up. I hate to use that old cliche, but that's what it is. They show up and they throw up and they call it selling. That's not selling. That's showing. That's telling. You're not selling. And I think that is the biggest mistake. I think if salespeople were really serious about their profession, they would go to Toastmasters. They would learn how to present. They would learn the art and science of actually doing a presentation. And again, sadly, 80-20 rule. I'm telling you, I think I'm being generous with the 80, by the way. They're horrible presenters. They're just poor presenters. And I think, you know, I think if you're a VP of sales, for example, and you can't present, what does that tell the rest of your team? You just set the standard. That's you right. know, and so I used to see that a lot. And I was very, when I was VP of sales, I was working for a company called ADC Telecommunications. We were selling, you know, the copper and the fiber optics, everything that has to do with telecommunications, right? At the head end and everything you probably have in the ground today, cable, all that stuff, right? And so we were selling products at about a, I think, 30% above our competitors, 30%, somewhere even as high as 50%. And so my salespeople were forced to learn how to present. So when I did quarterly meetings and they presented, the regional managers or the directors, you know, I can't tell you how many times, you know, I just told them to sit down, just sit down. I don't want to hear it. Just I said, if you can't present the material right, just why don't you put the numbers up? Let's not waste any time. And I know that sounds hard, David, but let me tell you what happened. By the second or third quarterly meeting, these guys really just raised their standard presentation. They came in there. I mean, by the way, the first time I told them to sit down, they were so mad. I thought they were going to quit, some of them, right? But what was interesting is that by the time we had the third quarterly meeting, they almost came in with this attitude like, I'm going to show this guy that I can present. And their presentation skills just, I mean, amazing. And the numbers don't lie. David, in 2.5 years, we went from $14 million to $98 million in sales.
Wow.
And that was a territory that had never gone past $14 million in the 10 years they had developed it. And so we did that in 2.5 years. And everybody who was on my team was required to present. And everybody understood that if you presented in front of Victor, it better be good. And if you didn't prepare for it, I would know. And I would call you out and it would not be fun. But I was fair. I wasn't evil. I didn't, you know, embarrass them too much. Just a little bit, David. You know what I mean?
just a little bit.
But I think you have to do that, right? You have to set the standard.
Yes.
And so everybody had to know how to present. And so when I asked you questions, you had to pitch it back to me in a way that would make me want to buy it. And I'm not talking about cheesy sales tricks, because when we're selling telecommunications equipment, these are long sales cycle items. So I'm talking B2B here. So again, it applies to B2B as well.
Well, again, so many takeaways there from setting the standard for yourself and your team if you're in leadership. Also, one thing that you mentioned, Victor, that I think is important that we all fall into in behavioral science, we call it self-handicapping, where we don't take responsibility for our poor results. We blame it on something, like it's the leads mm-hmm. or, you know, they never listen or whatever, the venue was wrong, rather than taking that responsibility. So mm-hmm. all of us fall into that trap, so make sure you're not self-handicapping.
Yeah. Can I just add something, David, before I forget on self-handicapping?
Sure.
Because this gets back to mindset. That same position I had, that was my first VP of sales position, and a quick story, but it's an important story, is that after the first quarter, I remember the president of division called me in, and he really wanted me to succeed. And I remember, you know, he asked me a question. He said, Victor, he says, what can I do to help you succeed? And without thinking, David, this is where I got my first lambasting, one of many to come. But it was, as soon as I said that, you know, as soon as he said, what can I do to help you? I said, well, I said, his name was Lynn. I said, Lynn, if you can lower the price, we can sell more. Thinking that's the answer, right? Look, if you give me a better price, we can sell more in this territory. And I remember he just went dead silent, David, and he just stared at me. You know that stare that seems like it's an eternity? You know, it's like, it's just a stare. And then he finally said this. He said, Victor, let me ask you a question. And to which I said, yes. He said, if in order to grow that region, I have to lower my price, why don't I do this? Why don't I fire you and I fire your whole sales team and just send the customer a brochure? Therefore, I can probably cut costs very easily that way. Do you still want to talk about pricing? And I remember I looked at him and I go, no, I don't know who brought that up. You know what I mean? No, I don't want to talk about this. I don't know who brought that pricing. And so, in other words, he set the standard also. Yes, we're more expensive. You know, kidding aside, he said, of course we're more expensive. But, and that's why we're the best. You know, we have the better product. Your salespeople need to sell it that way. And so he gave me the attitude that price was not an excuse. So I, as a VP of sales, turned around and did the what to my salespeople? Price is not an excuse. You're not getting discounts. You know, this is the way it's working. So it was a mindset. And so he removed that handicap, going back to your phrase. You know, he removed that handicap in my brain. So that's important. You have to have the mindset. If you believe in your product, then show the attitude.
What a great story. Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, it's so important to a lot of what you said. Just to remind our listeners that the way you present something shapes how it's perceived and whether or not it will be acted upon. So if you don't like the results you're producing, to Victor's point, change them by changing you, by taking responsibility and getting education and getting help. There's so many resources out there right now. I mean, just on YouTube, you have a great YouTube channel with hundreds and hundreds of videos that provide just, I mean, right there at your fingertips. So there's really no excuse anymore. There's so much information to take responsibility.
I agree with you. And by the way, a lot of stuff you do, David, you know, again, with the neuroscience stuff, I think, you know, companies really need to start applying that stuff to their presentations. You know, it used to be the, you know, they always talk about the art and science of presentations, right? And I think there was a time before people had a lot of information, pre-internet, where it was mostly art. You know what I mean? It was about the aggressive pitch, positioning. You know, you wear the nice suit, you slick your hair back, whatever, you drive up in a BMW. It was all about the art. It was all about sizzle, no steak. Well, I think we've moved over towards, it's now becoming, the art part will always be there, that component, but I think it's now heavily weighted towards, once we understand the neural science of why people make decisions, we can be more effective presenters. And so I think the stuff that you guys train on is excellent. I think that needs to be embedded more. And I think people need to pay more attention to the science piece of presenting and not just focus on the art.
It gives you an unfair advantage and allows you to really be, it's the most buyer-centric approach because it's all about the buyer. It starts not with, you know, how do I like to sell or how have other salespeople sold, but it starts with how does the brain make a buying decision? How is it influenced? How is attention created? How is cognition occur? And then based on that, now I create my presentation, my strategies, my behavior. So it's all about who the sales should always be about, which is the buyer. So
yes,
it's incredibly powerful. Absolutely. Oh, well, Victor, we could talk all day here, but this is...
I think we could, David.
I would enjoy it, but I know we both have other responsibilities. But boy, it's been a fascinating conversation, and you've given our listeners so many very practical, thought-provoking strategies and ideas. If our listeners do want to learn more about you and your work and your show, where can they go?
The easiest one is to go to my website, victorantonio.com. Just victorantonio.com. If you just search on YouTube, just type in Victor Antonio Sales and all the information, or the show Life or Debt, and you'll find the videos. But the main source is victorantonio.com, so they can just go there.
Excellent. Yeah, and I'd highly recommend you check out Victor's show, Life or Debt. That's Sunday nights on Spike TV. And again, his website and YouTube channel have a lot of great resources as well. You'll definitely want to check out. Well, Victor, thank you so much for joining me today.
David, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, special thanks to our guest, Victor Antonio, for sharing some fascinating and very actionable insights with us. And join us here next time on the Huffell Group podcast. And remember, selling is just too important to be based on anything other than proven science.